coffee that's just fully warm. Fool me, we can't get fooled again.
Arf. Hounds of heaven, Jesus loves you and is there for you. Welcome in to the David L. Gray Show, off code and unscripted. Got three things for you this morning. Michael Litchens from Catholic Exchange will be on to talk to us about the Dies Irae, literally meaning the Day of Wrath. It's a medieval Latin poem and one of the most famous melodies of the Gregorian chant. He'll be on to talk about the Dies Irae in Catholic tradition. Number two, got a quick review of the movie Father Stew for you. I'm going to go see it this Saturday. I liked it, and I'll tell you why. And then my commentary on the readings at Mass coming up next. But first, the sponsors. This show is being sponsored. Hey there. Thanks. Let me try that again. This show is being sponsored by, where is it? There we go. This show is being sponsored by St. Dominus Media. We got a new book out, our second book this year. This one is called Catholic, Traditional, and Black. So what this is a collection of essays. It's an anthology about Catholics who society would look at and just say, oh, they're Black and forced upon them all types of monoliths and stereotypes. But these individuals actually live their lives not according to some sort of imaginary race construct, but according to what the Catholic Church teaches. They live their life as Catholics, and everything else in their life is informed by that. So not only they're Catholics, which is rare, right, amongst those who we consider Black Americans, but they're also traditional, either in liturgical rite preference, Eastern or Latin, but also, or they're just traditional inner devotional Catholic faith practices. So very fascinating book. This book is really, it's just filled with inspiring stories about why these five individuals either became Catholic or remained Catholic and chose tradition. And I think it really breaks every stereotype, every assumption about Catholics who are identified as Black Americans in our society, right? And then in the introduction of the book, what I think you really find fascinating, in the introduction of the book, I have, it's a very long introduction. It's like a, it's pretty in depth. I make the case, I would say that. I push back against everything that's popular in society today, from the critical race theory to this idea that we should have these affirmative action saints. You know, there's these people who think we should just make people like Venerable Father Gus Tolton, Venerable Henriette de Lau, Venerable Pierre Toussaint. We should just make them saints just because they're Black, right? And so I push back against that. I really make the case how the traditional Latin rite is the inheritance of those who would call themselves Black Catholics, because since 1565, the first Blacks or dark-skinned people from Africa in this country celebrated traditional Latin rite. Every saint, a person being considered for sainthood, that will consider themselves while they're living Black Americans, from Tolton to Servant of God Mary Lang, Servant of God Julia Greenlee, all of them traditional Latin rite Catholics. So I make that case that tradition is the inheritance, and also that Catholicism, everything that ails society today in every community, every problem that we're having, only thing that we have to do is embrace the orthodoxy of the faith. So I make that case in the book as well. So it might be one of my favorite books, right? Maybe. It may turn out to be. It's really different than anything else I've written in any other book that I've ever published with St. Dominic's Media. So that's that. So yeah, it's available at Amazon.com for now, but other retailers like Barnes & Noble and blah, 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 coming soon, they'll have the hard copy. But if you go to stdominicsmedia.com, you'll get free shipping. And if you use the code SPRING22, you'll get 20% off. So check it out. Really fascinated by that. That's the only sponsor you're going to be seen on the channel for the next 2 weeks. So I'm dropping all the other sponsors and really just pushing this book, because I think it's what society needs right now. Also, this show is being sponsored by you, my patrons, whose names are scrolling below. If you're not a patron, if you don't support the channel at the $10 level or more, support, you go to davidlgray.info, register there, or go to patreon.com and subscribe there. So that's patreon.com. But most of all, I appreciate all you guys, likes, shares, subs, everything like that. So thank you for that. Also, thanks for buying the merch, the t-shirts, the hats, everything like that. So about to get into the readings for today. Then I'll give my quick review of Father Stu. And then Michael Litchens, he'll be on to talk to you about something very fascinating, something I just recently learned about. So that's going to be good. But that's all I know about that. So the readings at Mass today. So today is Tuesday in the Easter octave, octave meaning eight. So there's 8 days from Sunday to Sunday where we're given to hear various post-crucifixion theophanies of the risen Lord. So on Monday of the Easter octave is Matthew's account of Jesus appearing to Mary Magdalene and the other Mary after he left the tomb. Today, it is John's account of the angels and Jesus appearing to Mary Magdalene. On Wednesday, the fourth day of the octave is part one of Luke's accounts of Jesus appearing to the disciples on the way to Emmaus. And then the next day, Thursday, is part two of that. It finishes up. Then Friday, on the sixth day of the Easter octave, Jesus appears to disciples on the Sea of Tiberias. Saturday is Mark's account of Jesus appearing to Mary Magdalene. Then on the final day of the Easter octave, which is also Divine Mercy Sunday, it is John's account of Jesus appearing among the disciples. He breathes on them and establishes the sacrament of penance and reconciliation. And then there's the exchange with Saint Thomas, the doubting one. So a few things about today's reading from John chapter 20, verses 11 through 19. So of all the 16 didactic mysteries, that is all the narratives that all of the gospels have in common, this one with Jesus appearing to the women is probably the most varied of the eyewitness accounts. And notice how John, he excludes the other women from his narrative. Not saying they aren't there, but really his theological accounts is really just focusing on Mary Magdalene. Perhaps we could say it that way. Who, like the other women, notice that Mary Magdalene, who like the other women, she's just there just doing Jewish stuff, right? She's just following conventional wisdom. She's following Jewish tradition. She's just there to anoint the corpse with spices and oils. And so she's just there doing what she would have done, right? Nothing extraordinary or special here that she's at the tomb, right? But then the body isn't there. And so she doesn't know why, right? She thinks it's stolen. So she goes to, she runs and tells Peter, the other disciple who Jesus loved, and she says, they stole the body. They took the body. So she's not even thinking about a resurrection or anything like that. But after Peter and the other disciple who Jesus loved, after they return home, the text says, that's where today's reading picks up. Mary's still at the tomb and she's weeping, right? And so the angels ask her, woman, why are you weeping? And so she tells them, and then the gardener, who's Jesus, asks her, woman, why are you weeping? So the same word, same time, I'll talk about that in a moment. And then Jesus says, so she realizes it's Jesus, after she hears a voice, and she's holding on to him. And Jesus says, stop holding on to me, for I've not yet ascended to the Father. Go to the brothers and tell them, I'm going to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God. So here's a takeaway. I got a few takeaways. So the first one is that conventional thought have always told us that Jesus told her that to stop holding on to him because Mary Magdalene was unclean or something like that. That's, we hear that. We've been hearing that story a lot, that interpretation of that she was unclean. She was somehow defiling him. I think such notion, such interpretation, I think really betrays John, the Gospel of John, because John is quite intentional, right? He doesn't waste words. He's not just throwing stuff out there to see what sticks. No, he's John reconciles everything in his own gospel, or he's going to reconcile it with Genesis. I think in this instance, he's reconciling this with Genesis, this account here, because John in his gospel, he always uses this motif that Jesus is, he has to return to the Father. It's this motif of unity, all right? So Jesus is a source of unity with the Father, and he is uniting us with the Father. And I think this is the point that John is making with Mary Magdalene. So in Genesis, at the creation of woman, Adam says, "For this reason, a man leaves his father's home and he cleaves to his wife." Right? But John is saying here that the new Adam at the birth of the church, the bride of Christ, the son doesn't say he leaves the home of his father. Rather, he returns to the home of his father and he brings his bride with him. So this is the economy of unity now in the new covenant versus what we saw with Adam is like an economy of division and separation. You know, you take your wife, you go establish your own thing. Rather, here, Jesus is bringing us home to the Father. It's a different type of matrimony. So Mary Magdalene, in this case, is cleaving to Christ, but he needs to ascend so that he can cleave to his bride from the home of his father. So I think that's a more reasonable, more logical reading of John, who again is quite intentional with his words. So the second point is that I find it beautiful that both the news of his birth and his resurrection was first communicated by the angels to the marginalized people of Jewish society, right? That is, the shepherds into women in this case. So both his resurrection, his birth and resurrection is communicated to angels, to the lowest people in society. In this case, the women were sent out as prophets really to bear witness of the resurrection. Women, of course, I think we all know this, are far more loyal than men. So I think it makes sense. But I think more beautifully, we would say that those who are capable of birth, women, those who are most like his mother, Mary, are given the news to announce the birth of the church. So those who are capable of giving birth announce the birth of the church. So here's the last takeaway. So I love how Mary has to be asked twice, right? By the angels and Jesus. Woman, why are you weeping? Woman, why are you weeping? I think it's true oftentimes that we can apply this to ourselves, that sometimes in life we mourn when we should be rejoicing. No matter what happens to us, no matter what happens to you today, what happens to you this week, whatever happened to you yesterday, we have to remember that God is present with us at all times. He's present with us to bring us back to the Father, bring us into our inheritance, bring us into our true joy. And so if we really truly believe that, I think no one would ever cry at a funeral. Unless you truly believe that the person who just died went to hell. That's all I know about that. So Father Stu went Saturday to see Father Stu with the wife, and I really liked the movie. And so my wife did not want to go, right? She doesn't like Mel Gibson. She doesn't like, or actors. She doesn't like Mark Wahlberg or Mel Gibson as actors, right? And she assumed that the movie is just going to be some overly pious mishmash, right? But about three quarters of the way through, we're sitting there in the lounge chairs at a Marcus Theater. She leans over and says, "I was wrong. It was all right," right? Which is, for a woman who never admits she's wrong, this was just unsolicited praise, right? So I was really shocked, right? It was a movie. It was good. I liked it. I will watch it again. I probably wouldn't pay for it again. Not because it's not worthy of paying for, but just because I'm not into paying what I had to pay to watch this movie. And look, I know there's people out there saying that the movie took liberties, that it's not really what happened in the real life of Father Stuart Long from Montana. Look, I get it. But purists, you guys really annoy me. right? It's a movie. It's an adaptation. No, the movie is never as good as a book. Stop saying that. We get it. All you people who have like a cow because the new Lord of the Rings has black elves and somehow it betrays J.R.'s Tolkien vision of this all white elven kingdom, or those you who are like having a cow because Star Trek Discovery, some of his ships have propulsion flames shooting out and it somehow betrays the vision of Glenn Gene Roddenberry. Listen, keep your purism to yourself, right? And let the rest of us just enjoy fiction and adaptations, all right? The movie Father Stu, what I like about it is like the life of the real Father Stu is a great testimony of just redemptive suffering and someone just selling out for purpose and for Christ and for love, right? Someone who has encountered the truth and just has no recourse but to just follow the truth. I think that's amazing. Yes, the movie has a lot of impiety, cursing, has some crude, lewd talk. But if you've ever been to a Walmart at any time of the day, you've seen this. This is reality. I remember my brother, one of my youngest brothers, I tried to get him to come to the Catholic Church, and he's in RCIA, right, when we were in Youngstown at St. Dominic's, and he was just like Father Stu. I mean, just out there, right? So this is reality. Broken people do broken things. But the point of all that brokenness in a movie, of this movie, is just redemptive suffering and power to cross. So two things I really liked about the movie is that it represented Catholicism really well, right? Not perfectly, but really well. I don't think no one walks away from the movie thinking bad theology, right? So kudos for whoever they hired as their Catholic consultants. Good job. What I did not like about the movie was Teresa Ruiz, right, who played Carmen. During Ash Wednesday, her ashes were upside down, which it just irked me the whole time she's on the screen and her cross is like upside down. It just felt demonic to me and I didn't like it. And they could have done anything. I mean, the people who like put the ashes on there, I mean, they know that was a bad ash job. I mean, we've all been to Ash Wednesday. We had some bad ass jobs. We had the smudge. But the upside down cross, come on. I just thought that was unnecessarily unnecessary, right? So, and I don't fault Father Stu either in a movie. Now they have the picture of Teresa Ruiz up here, right, who played Carmen. So in the movie, spoiler, right, he becomes Catholic because of Teresa Ruiz. But honestly, I mean, who wouldn't, right? I mean, if I was a single guy and I was like an atheist and I saw Teresa Ruiz, I'm converting too. I mean, she could be a Muslim. I'm just kidding. But yeah, good job bringing Teresa Ruiz into the movie. Beautiful woman. Great movie. That's all I know about that. Right after the commercial, Michael Litchens from Catholic Exchange comes on and talks about Dad's Adoration with us. But for now, that's all I know about that. Michael Litchens is here from Catholic Exchange.
Good morning, David.
Good morning. Let me get Teresa down here.
So, better to look at that than me. It's fine.
Yeah, for now. For now. But thanks for coming on. So let me introduce you real quick. So Michael J. Litchens is the editor of Catholic Exchange. When he's not revising or editing, he is often found studying and writing about G.K. Chesterton, religion and literature, and random points of local history. He holds an A.M. degree from the University of Chicago Divinity School and a Bachelor of Arts from the Thomas More College of Liberal Arts. Michael, what is an A.M.? I don't think I've ever heard
of
it. I
really should just spell it as M.A. That's just the pretentious thing. I don't know why I keep calling it an AM. No one else does. But yeah, it's the, I guess it's the more archaic version because it would have been in Latin. So it's the more archaic version, but no one uses it. So
yeah,
except look at you, Chicago.
Yeah. Look at you being fancy. I like that though. That's good. Speaking of that, so man, so happy to have you on here on the morning show, David O'Gray off Code Unscripted. I know you're a very busy guy. Everyone who's a Catholic at some point in time has made their way to Catholic Exchange for something. How did you, before we get into the book, I just wonder, how did you get involved in that work? And tell us just a little bit about what you're doing at Catholic Exchange.
Sure. This is always a frustrating question for me to answer for people who have to listen, because if I'm honest, I kind of fell into editing and even Catholic Exchange completely by accident. I mean, I didn't set out when I went to school, when I said I'm going to go to Divinity School, get my master's degree, going to earn that PhD and teach, realized academia was not for me or anybody who has a human soul, no offense, but just was not going to work for me. And so I kind of fell into editing as the backup, but learned I really enjoyed doing it. I love working with authors. I really like that as you describe it, we have a little resource for everyone who at any stage in their Catholic faith. I love that. If you have a question about the Catholic faith, chances are someone on our team has answered it at some point. Yeah. And we love to be on top of that. We like to be, we have our mission statement is summed up as we want to make saints in our lifetime. And I think the best way we can make saints is to teach people what it means to be a Catholic, what it means to be this, you know, a Catholic Christian in today's world, and to help others to teach others.
Yeah. And so that's kind of like me, you know. Well, I went to school, you know, went to Ohio Dominican University to get a master's degree in theology because I thought I was going to, well, I started because I thought I was going to be a priest one day.
Oh, wow.
And then, yeah, I didn't realize that, you know, God hadn't called me to that. And then I'm like, man, what do you do now with a master's degree in theology? So it's like, you know, right. So I'm here doing a podcast. But
it's that are working at Walmart, I guess. I don't know.
Right. Even though you could use a theology degree as a greeter, right? There's some opportunity there.
Oh, yes.
So, yeah. But so as an editor, is that how you, I mean, so what is your, because, oh, talk us a little bit about the Dies Irae. I hope I'm pronouncing that right.
Absolutely.
Tell us a little bit about that and how you got involved with that, because, you know, I'm a convert to the faith from 2006. This is really my first encounter with this. Oh, wow. So tell us more about this.
So I converted in 2005. So I'm just 1 year older than you in terms of Catholic faith. So I'm with you on that. I learned about the Dies Irae. Oh gosh, it must have been about, well, I mean, I knew the music, you know, you hear the music, the title for Mozart and things like that, just through osmosis, or I love a lot of classical music, so I've heard about it, but I didn't really learn about its origins and this fantastic story of this miraculous song until maybe 6 years ago, 6-7 years ago, and it popped up because there was some viral video from, of all places, Canadian Broadcasting Company. Oh. About how Dies Irae is a song everyone kind of knows because it appears in soundtracks.
Oh, okay.
From The Lion King to Star Wars. If you like, once you hear it and once you watch any YouTube video that just type in Dies Irae movies.
Yeah.
There's a professor at the Berklee School of Music in Massachusetts. In fact, I can't remember his name, but he collects a list of soundtracks that include Dies Irae, and it's into the triple digits now.
Oh, wow. So
it's been used and everything. Again, Lion King or It's a Wonderful Life is probably one of the more famous ones. You can hear it very clearly when Jimmy Stewart's character is on the bridge begging for Clarence to give him his life back. You can hear the Dies Irae in the background very clearly. And that's,
oh, wow.
And it kind of gives you an idea of what the song's about, actually, that one scene in that context.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's a fascinating one.
And it literally means like Day of Wrath.
Yes. Right? Day of Wrath. Irae, you know, that's that root word where we get irate, irritated, things like that.
Yeah.
It, but in Latin, it means wrath. Like, that is not just anger or a little ticked off. It is... probably, unfortunately, how I feel in traffic most days nowadays, but if I'm being honest, I'm not good at that, but I, you know, that feeling of just like, I am going to burn this down.
because do you live in, you still live in Chicago?
I don't live in Chicago anymore. I live in Denver, which is somehow worse than Chicago in terms of traffic. But...
Yeah. What a beautiful town. Oh, I was just there not long ago. Beautiful, beautiful town. I had no idea it was so metropolitan. So that shocked me.
I know it does.
Let's back up for a minute. I want to get talk more about like the importance of the text. I want you to, because you could hear it, but also I want you to read the stanzas.
Because
I thought the text itself was beautiful. I went back up for a moment because I know you're a convert to the Catholic faith. So tell us just a little bit about your faith journey, because we always find that type of stuff inspiring.
Yeah, it's like Augustine said, it's kind of a pilgrimage in and of itself. Like, and it's still one I'm trying to figure out and walk on and keep tripping over my own feet on. But I grew up evangelical, very much evangelical Pentecostal somewhere, Foursquare Gospel Church, for all you guys who might know Amy Simple McPherson, folks like that.
Okay.
And well, I kind of lost all interest in that particular branch of Christianity by the time my teen years rolled around, and I go back and forth on why I lost interest and lost my faith. And it came down to, I just had trouble taking it seriously. And this isn't me bashing evangelicals. There are many, many good ones in this and other countries, but my particular church and my particular experience, it was hard to take seriously because it seemed like there were rules, but not really. And they could change depending on who got to be pastor year after year, which pastor you talk to. And I try not to be too morally rigid like I was in my teen years and early 20s, but I was, and it was really hard for me because I would want to know, well, how do I get to heaven? Well, you have to do this, but don't do works either because we don't believe in works. And then like, well, but you just, what did I say? And it wasn't until my late teens, I converted at 21, that I kind of discovered Catholicism largely through the writings of G.K. Chesterton. I found him by accident in a used bookstore and immediately fell for him. I really love the Neil Gaiman describes that he is a man who really loves the English language. Like each word, each letter is chosen to make an impact. And I love what he had to say. And well, Catholicism, as you probably know, it's a big deal to him. It was a huge deal.
You had read Chesterton in his Catholic phase, so you didn't read the earlier. Where'd you come in? You came in Everlasting Man, or where'd you come in at?
I came in, oddly enough, it was his fiction. It was The Man Who Was Thursday originally.
Oh, wow.
And I really loved it. Like, it's like magical realism meets spy novel. That's the only way I can describe it. I really don't know how to describe it, but it's a bizarre, over-the-top early 20th century novel, and but he quotes so many great lines in there. He uses a lot of Thomistic thinking with some of his characters, like how do we arrive at knowing if someone's lying to us and things like that. And, from there, I found more of his books and just kept going.
So that kind of sparked your Catholic imagination. I see that's kind of like pretty similar to me. So my first encounter with Catholicism was, I think, Follett. I forget his first name, but it was his book, Pillars of the Earth.
Yes.
Ken Follett.
I love that book.
Yeah. The first time I've really encountered Catholicism. That sparked my imagination as well.
Then when you get to Europe and you see the cathedrals after reading that book, you're like, oh my, you just they you like take on new life.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, what did you know about Catholics heretofore? When you were evangelical, did you have any notions?
I did. A lot of them negative, I'll be honest. But I had a very beloved grandma in my life who was as Irish Catholic as it got. That was my family's heritage going back. And I did love going to Mass with her. I loved a lot of the... It was all very, you know, rural Oregon parish, so it wasn't a lot of the smells and bells I now gravitate towards. But it was a very lovely priest, very great service. Pretty traditional for Novus Ordo, all things considered. Yeah. Especially with my grandma, that's what she liked. And she also liked it when the priest kept his homily under 15 minutes. She was very big on that. And she was a great example of like how much peace I saw it bring to her and how much joy it brought to her. So yeah. I never had the bigotry, thankfully, against Catholics. But yeah.
Yeah. Wow. So we're speaking with Mr. Michael Litchens. He is the editor over at Catholic Exchange. He's involved in Sophia Institute's press. Their work is a reproduction of quite old work, Dies Irae, The Day of Wrath. So it's an old Gregorian chant. Michael is saying everyone's heard it probably at some point in time. He's going to read one of the stanzas pretty soon. Please. So that's who we're speaking with today on the David Gray Off Code and Unscripted. Talk now about his conversion story. He converted back to the faith in 2005 by first encountering G.K. Chesterton. And from there, what happens, Michael?
Wow. Let's see. A lot of fits and starts. I found a good parish in my hometown, and it was with the Dominican Order, which was especially helpful for a guy like me because to this day, I still adore the Dominicans. I have many great friends in that order. But it was wonderful to have that priesthood, those guys who really wanted to tackle the tough questions and weren't afraid of me to ask them when I was first going through RCIA and thinking about, okay, is this for me? Is this not for me? How do you all know when to stand up and sit down? This is weird, but, you know, getting through the steps.
Yeah. Did you think about ever becoming a Dominican? Was that ever on the radar?
I did. I thought about becoming just about every religious order you could think of. that was not my calling, as it turned out. It took a little bit of time for me to really figure it out after several, you know, monastery visits and things like that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I'm now married, and I'm very happy with that.
So you discerned out of that whole thing. So that's in the discernment of marriage. So that's beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And in many ways, I like to think like reading all these great monastic texts and everything. I always challenge people, like, if you can read these and really sit down and think with St. Benedict or St. Dominic, you can become a better husband, coworker, whoever, because they help you just become a better person. Yeah. And it's not time wasted. So I'm really glad I got that exposure.
It must have been really refreshing coming from a church where you're struggling with the spontaneity and how things change and how fluid things are, to coming into a church where the liturgy is a liturgy, the dogma is a dogma. You can accept it, not accept it, but it's there, doesn't change. That must have been really refreshing.
It was. Chesterton uses a phrase describing dogmas that it's like building a fence around a playground. It's not there to imprison you or to keep you away from anything. It's there to protect you. It's there to also give you the freedom to play. And theology is kind of a weird play on things. Like, we always see that it's kind of God's slow revealing. I'm not saying God's playing games, but that was such a great thing to learn, that there is, you know, while there are these dogmas and there are all these, you know, places we can't go and all that, we have no problem as Catholics arguing and trying to answer these questions, because they're questions a lot of us have.
Yeah. It's beautiful. And I love how the dogma gives you like a boundary in which you can't like go out of. Right. So we had, but there's a lot of room there, but it gives us boundaries. Unlike we see in other faith traditions. So that's rich. Let's get back to the text. Yeah, can you read it for us? And then let me give an outline of the book. So you can find it, if you drop down into the description box below, you can go to Sophia Institute Press and check out the book and buy it there. But it's a simple layout. Mm-hmm. So it's a sequence for the Mass of the Dead. And the first from page 1 through 4 is just the introduction. Page 5 is from 5 to 8 is the text of the sequence in English. And also has, I think, is it in Latin?
Yes.
And then and then from like from pages from 9 to 112 is like an interpretation of it. So Michael's gonna tell us about that. Why do we need like 100 pages to tell us about it? But yeah, let's hear it, Michael.
Sure. So in the original Latin, it is Dies Irae, Dies Illa, Solvent Seculum in Favia, Teste David Concibia. And the adaptation you usually hear is Day of Wrath, O Day of Mourning, See Fulfilled the Prophet's Warning, Heaven and Earth in Ashes Burning. And then it goes on to the second stanza. I'll just read the English. Oh, what fear man's bosom rendeth when the heaven the judge descendeth, on whose sentence all dependeth. And that is the beginning of what becomes, as you can see, like just within that, there's a lot I could probably go into and explain, you know, David and Sybil and things like that. And that's why you suddenly get 100 pages getting into it.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. But why is it is played in such an important place in Catholic tradition? Was it just for the Requiem Masses, for Masses for the Dead, or how do we use it?
We use it, of course, in the Requiem Mass. That is where most people will hear it. But as I mentioned, it's been used in music for centuries. It goes back, depending on which scholar you ask, it probably comes from the 13th century from St. Francis's companion, Thomas of Celano, with additions happening in later centuries. But there's even a story that Gregory the Great was the originator of the poem. And he heard it from a dove who was the Holy Spirit whispering to him this song.
Wow.
So in a way, it's kind of the eternal song of death. Wow. And that's how it's often been depicted. And that's also why it has such cultural staying power.
Yeah. Yeah. Why do people think it's terrifying, though? What's terrifying about it?
Because it's describing at once both the end of all ages, but also the particular judgment every one of us will have to face at some point. It's also, in that way, it's the universal song of death, because we all have, death is the one that unites us all. Mm-hmm. We all have to go through it, rich, poor, whoever. We will have to endure it. And that is, when we think about it, we don't often like to think about it, unless you take up Memento Mori or some other sort of devotion. But death is a terrifying thing at points. It can be, you know, not just that, you know, what happens at the end, there's so much unknown, there's this, all these mysteries of what happens immediately after death, but also God is going to judge you. What am I worthy? Can I actually make it to that judgment seat, especially if God knows me as well as I know myself? I know I have a few things to answer for. So what will that judgment be? And that's why it tends to be a very terrifying thing. And plus, it's just the imagery, like even those first couple syllables, you know, it's wrath, mourning, and, you know, the prophets have warned you this day will come.
Yeah. And so does it help us answer those questions?
I think it does. I think it gives well, obviously we can't say anything, a lot of things definitively, but this book in particular, when you go through this, you'll hear these words so often in a mass, especially if you attend a more traditional requiem, but there's so much imagery here that is taken back, not just through the Bible, but even through various medieval accounts of Latin poetry and things of that nature. Yeah. And there's also the hope at the end that as you get through it, that you see there is hope and that God's mercy is indeed one that he gives out freely and gratuitously. So it is also full of hope at the end, but it is a warning to also to remember you don't always know what's going to happen with you.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's why, as Franco, she kind of chimes and said, death is scary, right?
Yes.
I think the older you get, the more mortality seems scary, right? It's that is coming.
I'm in my late 30s, man. Everything hurts. Yeah.
I was thinking about the other day, you know, I'm turning 50 this year, and I was thinking about when my mom was my age. I thought she was old as dirt. I mean, I'm making end of life plans for her. I'm thinking, and I'm asking her, you know, what's, you know, do you have end of life plans? You know, where do you want to be buried? When she is 50, my age, right? And so, and now I'm that age, right? But you know, 50 isn't that old. But you never now that I realize that, right? But yeah, you never know when your time is coming, right? So prepare your life as if it's always coming, right? So, but there's also like a motif of like the apocalypse in this text, right?
Yeah, that's the, you know, and once it's the end of the world, the end of all things, but also death is a sort of end of the world, especially if you have a more worldly or narcissistic outlook. Like, I think it was Ayn Rand who said, oh no, when I die, it won't be me dying, the world will die. And I reject that, of course, but at the same time, it does speak to this idea that many of us have of like, we can't imagine the world without us. So in a way, our own dying starts to feel like the end of the world. And it's understandable when you look at it that way. But there's also going to be the end of all things, as we were told and warned by Christ in the Gospels, and has been told, we can't tell you when that's going to happen. I'm not going to sell any books that say it's happening in 2048, but it can happen in our lifetimes, or I could fall down the stairs in my lifetime and not get up. Things like this happen. But either way, it's an ending and a terrifying idea of what's going to happen in that beyond.
Yeah. Now, Sophia Institute Press, if you guys are interested in learning more about the book, drop down into the link below. You can click on it, or you can just go to your Google and type in DIESIRAE or the sequence for the Mass of the Dead and Sophia Press. You can find it there. Michael Litchens here from Catholic Exchange doing a wonderful job being part of the work and promoting it. But part of that promotion is that you guys are promoting this as a devotional and a meditation. How does that work?
I would say that the lyrics themselves, every stanza of this poem has so much to reflect on and to think about. I mean, aside from the very large themes of, you know, judgment, death, the scary things we don't want to always talk about in our society, there's also a great hope of mercy and that God is, in fact, a good Lord and does keep his promises and can spare us from everlasting fire, even if we're sinful, even if we've waited till the last moment, if we're like the good thief, the robber who repented on the cross, we can still be saved. And so the devotional aspect comes from reflecting, I think, just on the lyrics, but because Nicholas Geer is such an incredible systemic theologian, and this book is a nice introduction into like the meaning of one of the most popular Latin hymns you could find. And just having that knowledge the next time you hear it at a funeral, or if you're like me and you now hear it in all your favorite movies, it will keep coming back to you.
Yeah. So this volume of pages of interpretation, was that just the work of one theologian or?
Yes. So that is the work of Father Nicholas Geer, who I'm spacing on the name of his. He wrote the book, The Holy Sacrifice of the Mass, which is probably one of the definitive single volume studies of the Mass. And it is, I mean, he's kind of a 19th century Romano Guardini is the best way I can describe him. He was the best systemic theologian in Germany at the time. He wrote quite a bit about the Mass, and that was the major parts of his doctoral studies at the Gregorium. And so just has a lot to, he has a lot of expertise, and it's all written by him.
Yeah. I think I have that book on my shelf. I
do too.
I never knew that. That's interesting. So let me just recap again for those listening to the audio version. So speaking with guest Michael Litchens, we were here talking about his conversion story, converted back in 2005 after spending a lot of time as evangelical. And one of the work he's been involved in lately, of course, you know, you can find the corpus of what he's doing, that's his work over at Catholic Exchange. But he's working with Sophia Institute Press on Dies Irae, which is the sequence of the Mass for the dead. The Day of Wrath, literally. It's called a musical gem, even without music. So, and it's called The Giant Among Hymns, which was composed by Thomas of Celano, a companion of the first biographer of St. Francis of Assisi. This reprint of a classic work of Monsignor Nicholas Geer expands upon Dies Irae from a devotional reading and meditation. But there's supposed to be some like stories surrounding this text. Like, what are some interesting stories that we should know about this book?
I did mention that one of the supposed origins is that it was given to Saint Gregory vision with the Holy Spirit.
Yeah.
I kind of tend towards that one, not just because Gregory the Great's one of my all-time favorite saints. But the official explanation is it was given to Thomas of Celano in what might have been, depending again on which source you go with, but he had supposedly received this in a particular mystical vision of seeing what the end of all things would look like, and both its terror and its glory, and that this was what inspired him to want to write this. And since then, I would say its most miraculous point is just how much it shows up in musical history. Mm-hmm. I've mentioned the movies a bunch of times, but even before that, it almost immediately had an impact on music. It's kind of one of those musical pieces that changed the course of musical history forever in the West.
Wow. Wow. And it sounds rich, and it sounds like providential. That's really amazing how it's used in context in a lot of these movies. So, that's really providential.
It really is, and that's why I can kind of see it as a sort of miraculous thing that I don't want to say that artists don't do the great work and don't, you know, put pen to paper and get this done, but there's something about God giving and communicating to us through art like he did with parables and stories that I think can be a very powerful way of teaching the truth.
Yeah. What impressed you most about the interpretation? I mean, once we get into that, because that's rich. We're talking about over 100 pages. I just gleaned through it. I didn't spend a whole lot of time because it's just you could spend so much time on just the interpretation itself. It's just so rich and deep. So what did you find there that will help the people who are listening, both live and those going to listen to the recording later? And why should they spend their time to go check out this book and consider purchasing it based upon the interpretation?
What I was most impressed with is it's 100 pages, which is a lot, but how much he covers in that 100 pages, and he's very spare with his words. He doesn't spend a lot of time, you know, staying on one area or whatever. He quickly moves through the stanzas, giving the interpretation. And just by going, if you don't even look at the lyrics, just going through his interpretation, you'll learn so much about Catholic history. It's very, like I said, he has a very rich imagination for like putting all these complex ideas into a paragraph. And you'll just get a very nice overview of Catholic history just by going through his interpretations. He'll refer to the Old Testament. You'll learn a little bit about the poetry of Virgil. And you'll come out with a lot more knowledge than you thought you could have about this period.
Yeah. And that's what I always appreciate. Probably like you appreciate a lot of the older writers and theologians, even in some of the older popes and some of their papal bulls and encyclicals. Because I always find that, you know, no offense to systematic theologians. I know, you know, systematic theologians. I know them, you know, God bless them. But I think theology done well just includes story and encompasses a lot of different things and brings it in. Mm-hmm. And it just makes it rich. It makes it relatable. And it makes a deeper impression, I think, upon it. It's transformative, right? So I think Pope Benedict XVI, I think he did it. Of the most recent theologians, I think he probably did it better than other people, bringing in imagination into theology to expand the mind and to grasp complex things in quite ordinary ways, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And so how does the author here do that when he's talking about, you know, Adam and Eve? He's talking about redemption. How are some ways that you think he does that well?
The author of the book or the poem, I'm sorry.
The interpretation, yeah.
Oh, the interpretation. I think Father Greer does a great job of telling the story of, in many ways, the whole history of salvation. I was trying to figure out the best way to describe what period he's covering, but it's a mini history of salvation in a way. And one of the things that stood out to me the most was he talked about, there's that line from the first stanza about David and Sybil. And if you don't read much in early medieval theology, you won't hear about the Sybils. But it's thought that one of the Sybils, the Cumaean Sybil, had actually prophesied Christ, even though she was a pagan, you know, prophetess and all this, but that God had somehow miraculously revealed just enough to the pagans so that they could be ready for Christ's eventual arrival into the kingdom of man being this point.
Yeah.
And this is it's a beautiful, rich story that kind of shows you a part of the Christian story you don't often hear, how God was not just preparing his chosen people, the Jews, for the arrival of Christ. He was in many ways giving hints to the pagans that this was going to happen, that they were going to get a savior, and that that some of the wiser ones were actually able to hear these prophecies and to give them. And so that's one of the things that stood out to me the most, is just that little story adds so much more context to the history of salvation.
Yeah. Now, if a person, you know, my audience is, you know, primarily, you know, people who go to the traditional Latin rites.
Sure.
And, you know, a lot of people here, they would love the Gregorian chants and things like that. But do people who worship in an Novus Ordo rite, do they also experience this during the funeral mass?
They often will. This is usually one of the few Latin hymns that someone in Novus Ordo Mass will ever hear, unfortunately.
Okay.
Well, fortunately that it's a good one and it's a beautiful one, that if you're going to hear only one or two, this is one of the one or two I would probably pick. But it's this one and perhaps something at Advent. And even this one is only at certain funerals, and I haven't seen it as often in the Novus Ordo. But I think it is being rediscovered, because a lot of people will be like, well, I want that one Mozart song. And a priest can gently say, that's Dies Irae. We can actually do that.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's good. That's good. That's awesome. So, I mean, what about you? What about yourself? Did you have like a liturgical rite preference, or where were you at coming into the faith, and where are you at now?
Yeah. Right now I'm mostly at a Novus Ordo parish, mostly because that's the one that was convenient to me for my schedule. But my usual parish has been, for the last couple near decade, was at a Melkite parish in New Hampshire until I moved to Denver. So I was very Byzantine and still have, like, it's my wife's seafaring stuff behind me, but my whole desk is otherwise icons.
Yeah. That's amazing how much you and I have in common, man. That's pretty amazing. Cause that's, I always say if I never left Columbus, Ohio, I probably would eventually transition east, you know, to the Melkite. But I don't know. It may happen one day. I'm here in St. Louis now, and so there's one here. But for other reasons, I just haven't, more practical reasons like you, I haven't, you know, ever made that transition. But that's fascinating. Yeah, I love St. Dominic's Media. We published a book not too long ago about the liturgy of St. John, St. Gregory of Nyssa, Gregory theologian. That book right there, one of my favorite books on the liturgy as far as like, you know, the Eastern rite. So I really love Eastern liturgy. So that's fascinating. Cool. So as we head out of here, I want to get some final thoughts from you about, and we've been speaking with Michael Litchens. He is the editor there over at Catholic Exchange. He's been working with Sophia Press on this book. We've been talking about Dies Irae. Hop down into the description box to click on the link to check it out over at Sophia Press. Or if you go over to Amazon, I think there's a, you can preview, see some of the text to see if you see if it works out for you. But what is your best pitch about why Catholics should invest in this. It's not really an expensive book either, but why should we invest in it as and use it as a meditation?
That is a great question. I would say what I don't want to so much as pitch it. I want everyone to buy it. I would have no problem if one of you bought it and shared it with your three friends. Please do. That's fine. But I think it's worth getting into because of the richness. And I mean that both in terms of how beautiful it is. It is a stunningly beautiful hymn. It's beautiful to just read out loud. But also because you will have so many ideas being exposed to you, even if you only take down little chunks of it, you only learn about the first two stanzas, let's say. You will learn so much about salvation history. And what I think is incredible, because this song's so much in the cultural zeitgeist, you will hear it everywhere, and it will bring these lessons to mind. At least that's been my experience. You can't even watch The Lion King without thinking about God and his salvation for mankind. So welcome to the club.
Yeah, I'm excited to get out on YouTube right now and just hear it in these places you told me I could hear it. So I'm excited. I encourage everyone else, if you haven't, you know, you heard Michael talk about you, it's been everywhere. Go out, let's go out to the YouTube or whatever and check these things out. And thanks for coming on, David Gray, Off Code and Unscripted, Michael.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me on and letting me nerd out about old Latin hymns again.
Yeah. I'll be back tomorrow. Guest is Paul Gary. We got another book review. We're talking about a reading of the Mass. I don't know what my monologue was going to be on tomorrow, but I appreciate everyone coming in. Make sure you like, share, sub, and do all that stuff. And I will see you on the next time. God bless you. Hey there. Thanks for watching the video. Please like, subscribe, and share. And visit me at davidlgray.info to check out the Catholic theology courses I'm teaching there to adults and to homeschool students. But most of all, remember, to get to confession and get to Mass as often as possible, and to make your life a type of liturgy at a Mass. But until then, and until next time, blessings and shalom to you and to yours.